You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Archaeological Fantasies Podcast, episode 84. I'm your host, Sarah, and I'm joined today by my co-hosts, Ken Fader and Jeb Card. And today we have special guest, ethnographer James Belio, who's here to talk to us about his studies on the Ark Encounter, located in Kentucky. James tells us about his time speaking with and studying the group responsible for putting the Ark together, and their opinions and views on what they were creating and how they were trying to communicate their beliefs with the outside world. Get ready to think critically.
Ranger trials as one will call. No, we don't do dinosaurs.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Archaeological Fantasies Podcast. I am your host, Sarah, and I am joined today by my co-hosts, Ken Fader and Jeb Card. How's it going, guys?
It is going wonderfully. We're sitting here in Connecticut waiting first for Hurricane Jose and then Marie, I believe.
Oh, that's right. We do have hurricanes.
Batten down the hatches, but there's no such thing as climate change.
Right. And today we are joined by our special guest, James Belio, who has come to talk to us about the Ark experience, or Ark Encounters?
Encounter, yeah.
The Ark Encounter. And James, you are an... Are you an ethnographer, or did you just luck into an ethnography?
Yeah, no, I'm an ethnographer by training, a cultural and linguistic anthropologist.
Could you tell people in our audience, they might not know in any kind of detailed way what an ethnographer is, what an ethnographer does. Just can you briefly describe the job of an ethnographer?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one way I like to think about it is just sort of a nice, pithy, hopefully nutshell way of thinking about it is doing long-term fieldwork with a community. And sometimes that means one place, and other times that means multiple places. But really core to the ethnographic enterprise is building relationships with people, building trust, getting to know more than just what one could read, say, in publicity materials or in recorded documents, and maintaining those relationships over time.
Yes. There was a time when I began teaching, when I could tell my students, ethnographer, you know, like Margaret Mead, and they knew what I was talking about.
Yeah.
That hasn't been true for a very long time. Margaret Mead is a very famous ethnographer.
And I can't think, I'm not going to do that. I can think of one or two names, but they're not that high profile like Margaret Mead was.
Right.
And another thing I often say is that ethnography sort of has components of art, science, and craft all rolled into one. I mean, it's scientific in the sense that it's systematic, and it tries to, ask formulated questions and have defined methods. But at the same time, it has elements of art, the management of relationships, and improvisation, creativity, and perhaps more than anything, it's a craft. You know, it's something you get better at all the time, but you never really perfect.
Mm-hmm. So, James, can you tell us about the project that you did? You just wrap this up, or?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I've just wrapped it up, and in other ways, I'm at the beginning. So, I'll sort of talk through that transition a little bit. Maybe just to take a quick step back and contextualize the project that you all want to hear the most about. So all of my work has been ethnographic and is centered on the cultural variation that exists within American evangelical and fundamentalist communities. I started out, I did a linguistic anthropology project that really focused on religious reading. So there was a lot here on how people construct and perform and negotiate different ideologies about scripture through talk in the context of the weekly congregational small group, which is, of course, pervasive. On the American landscape, as well as, Christianity found elsewhere. That then led to a project that focused on a movement of cultural critique among progressive evangelicals. So I sort of went from working with sort of mainstream conservative evangelicals to more progressive evangelicals. And so really what that boiled down to is that in all kinds of ways, from Bible reading to worship to activism to how they engaged popular culture, they were interested in sort of working against the status quo of mainstream conservative evangelicalism. So they fashioned themselves as change agents, and I was trying to kind of get inside that movement. So right as I was finishing that project up, it was December 2010, and I saw an interview. It was about a 15-minute interview, and it was it featured the governor of Kentucky on stage with personnel from a ministry, a young earth creationist ministry called Answers in Genesis, which is based in northern Kentucky. And the purpose of that 15-minute news conference was to announce their latest project. So Answers in Genesis is the ministry behind the Creation Museum, which opened up in 2007. It's a $30 million facility. And so they're celebrating their 10th anniversary this year. And the press conference was announcing their newest project, which they were calling Ark Encounter. And it was a life-size, according to their reading of Scripture as biblical literalists, a life-size recreation of Noah's Ark, and sort of done in the register of a Disney-style theme park. So I heard about this, and my initial thought was, you know, that's pretty fascinating. I hope somebody does something on that. Because to be honest with you, and really this is still the case, and it's been the case throughout the research, is that creationism per se hasn't really interested me. We kind of know who creationists are. An anthropologist named Chris Toomey wrote a great book published back in 1994 called God's Own Scientist. And it really does a wonderful job at the time and still today of sort of sketching out in cultural terms who creationists are and how that movement works. So it wasn't creationism per se. It was the idea of getting behind the scenes that I thought would be an anthropological story worth telling. So my sort of thought was, you know, if I could just, you know, ask them if they would allow me as an anthropologist to observe their creative process over the course of the time it took them to build this park, and that would be the focus of the project, the sort of the behind the scenes making of. Now that would be good. And so that thought kind of stuck in my head for a few months. And it was April 2011 when I first tried to contact them. A few weeks went by and I got a phone call back. And it was one of the administrative assistants for the ministry and really one of the only gatekeepers before I was talking to one of the founders of the ministry. And so he and I went back and forth over the summer of 2011. Basically arranging meetings and then him rescheduling them because he was traveling all over the place, primarily doing fundraising. So finally, at the end of August 2011, he and I did a one-hour phone interview. And really, it was him interviewing me. I mean, I was asking some basic questions about the project, but you know, he was trying to get a sense for what I meant by research, what I meant by doing ethnography, what I meant by fieldwork, what I meant when I said I wanted to observe the process. And so after that 1 hour interview, he said, sure, come on down. And I was thrilled. So in October of 2011, I went down to the design studio in Northern Kentucky for the first time and was really blown away. You know, I walked in and immediately there were sort of blueprints everywhere. And there was this sort of genre of art on the wall that I came to learn is called concept art. You know, it's sort of early phase production of different exhibit ideas. And the place is just surrounded by this. And I was sort of enthused. I'd never been in that kind of space before. You know, I'm not an artist. I've never worked in a design studio. And I presented the same sort of rationale for the project to the creative director. So in good, you know, sort of all ethnographic fieldwork, if it's being done properly, follows informed consent, meaning that the people that you're working with know exactly who you are and exactly what you're doing. And they sign on and sign off. You know, it's and ethnography really is enabled by the graciousness of strangers, strangers who become people that you know better. I like to think of October 2011 as kind of when the fieldwork began in earnest. And what that kicked off was 2.5 years of me spending time with the team. Primarily, I was sitting in cubicles with artists while they worked, observing their process, asking them questions, trying not to be too distracting or annoying, sitting in on team meetings, of course, doing interviews, that sort of thing. As I said, you know, following the process as it evolved. So I sort of fashioned it as a study in cultural production and religious creativity. And ultimately, a project that was about the relationship between religion and entertainment, with the relationship between religion and science not ignored, but sort of displaced, because so much of the writing and the anthropological discussion about creationism takes place within that frame, that intellectual frame, that analytical frame, of religion and science. How are they related? How do people make them work? And I wanted to respect that, and I wanted to participate in those conversations, but I wanted to do so with a new vantage point. Again, we know who creationists are when we look at them as creation scientists, you know, that label that they have been claiming for themselves since the early 60s. But what do we learn different when we look at the creative creationists, the creationist artists, or as they identify themselves early on in the project, creationist imagineers?
James, let's clarify. Can we have one point of clarification here?
Yeah, sure.
So you were totally upfront who you were.
Of course.
There was no effort on your part to say, well, listen, I'm one of you guys. And I'm so they understood that you are somebody coming from a background of science who wasn't necessarily going to agree with their worldview. But that raises the obvious question in my mind. Now, you mentioned Chris Toomey. Chris is a great guy. He was a grad student at UConn when I was there a few years after I arrived, and he presented some of that research before it became the book God's Own Scientist. And the question that I asked Chris is the question I'm going to ask you, which is, why would these folks open their doors to somebody like you or like Chris Toomey, who obviously, at least there was the possibility that you were going to conceivably portray them in a negative light, that you were not necessarily going to be friendly towards them. Why would they? I will bet you that even without the political and religious and political, without the political and religious background, that if you had asked to do this at Disney, they would have turned you down because there's a closed shop. So why did they say, sure, come on in?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I will try to sort of do some informed speculation. It's one I thought about immediately, you know, when they said yes, I was taken aback, really. I expected them to say no. I mean, a few possibilities, and then one that I think to me makes the most sense. I mean, one possibility would be them saying and sort of taking the stance of, you know, hey, this guy's free press. You know, he'll write for an audience that maybe wouldn't normally read about us or something to this effect. And maybe that, you know, has some merit. Maybe that had something to do with their decision. Another would be, you know, this guy doesn't really matter, right? I mean, you know, we're building ultimately what the first phase was $92 million, right? We're building a $92 million theme park. Sure, this guy can come in. Who cares, right? He's a nobody. He doesn't matter. You know, what's he going to do, right? I mean, we're answers in Genesis. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's some of that, you know, like what harm could it possibly be, sort of thing. To me, something else makes more sense. Again, not that those two couldn't have a part to play. It's, you know, and this happens to ethnographers wherever they do work, right? Ethnographers come in and they want to do something that's odd, right? They want to participate, but not as a full insider, right? They maybe want to do some insider things, but at least historically and for most anthropological work, you're coming in and you're doing things, interviewing people, taking notes, recording that nobody else does as part of daily life, right? And so anthropologists have been, you know, put in the slot of spies, of missionaries, of government officials, right? These are sort of classic
examples. They've all been at one point somewhere.
They have all been at
Jeb has talked about this in a number of the podcasts, how these archaeologists, some of whom are icons in the field, were actually working for the CIA or some other spy organization.
Exactly. And so from the community standpoint, I mean, what they're doing is they're putting you in a familiar category. Right. You know, you're coming in and you don't fit in a category. So they're you in one. And so the category that I made the most sense in was a journalist coming in, even though they knew I wasn't a journalist. And so to me, this was reflected in a couple of ways. Well, so what they're used to, right, what they're used to is a journalist coming in, spending, you know, kind of a long weekend, maybe sometimes a little longer, usually shorter, but maybe on average like a long weekend, taking a ton of pictures, doing kind of real direct, but fairly succinct interviewing. And then they're gone. And then something appears in writing. And sometimes it's critical. Sometimes it's hostile. Sometimes it's sympathetic. And that's what they're used to. So I'd been coming around for about 6 months. And I remember distinctly, I walked in and the creative director said, James, you're back. And so I think it was moments like that where I sort of started to no longer fit in that category they had placed me in. And then at one point, you know, the question stopped being when are you going to not be here? The question started being, when are you going to write something? Right. It didn't make any sense to them that I'd been there for, you know, a year, 2 years and hadn't written anything yet. So all of that, right, took some getting used to on their part. Mm-hmm. So I think sort of having this familiar category of journalist who comes in at ready that they could place me in allowed me to stick around. And then I eventually sort of got outside of that category. And then, and I'm happy to sort of tell this story at some point, you know, they ended the relationship, not acrimoniously or anything like that, but they basically said the field work was over unilaterally. So that's my best answer. I don't know if that's satisfying or interesting to you.
Yeah. Well, I have two. Okay, go ahead, Ken.
No, I was just going to say that when I asked Chris Toomey the same question, the implication I got from Chris was that these are folks who are so certain of their worldview, they're not afraid of anybody questioning it because they know, they believe very strongly that a fair, objective, even-handed analysis of what they're doing, that not necessarily scientists, but real people will understand and recognize, oh yeah, they're doing great stuff. Mm. And so they're not really concerned about anything negative that you possibly could say.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think I certainly that's a cultural trait of fundamentalism is this sort of certainty. Not that they never doubt as individuals, but certainty as an imperative is absolutely there. And yeah, I don't think they're worried about a critique that I would level at them.
Well, I would like to ask a question that kind of follows up on both Ken's question and the things James have been saying. I have read another book by Chris Toomey, Conjuring Science, which talks about use of symbols of science in various ways, one of which is creationism, but not the only one. I have not read his other book. And so maybe one or the other of you can answer the question I have, which then falls into a sort of another kind of angle on this. I've not been to the Ark Encounter, but I have talked on the show. In fact, in the first episode, which is a two-parter because I can never shut up, about, as you all know.
But we love you anyway.
Well, yeah. It's a gift. It's a curse. But I have been to the Creation Museum with James, actually. And does Toomey talk about oppositional stances or oppositional positioning? And we're about to come up on our break in a few minutes. So I'm gonna put this out there a little. The Creation Museum, again, I've seen things from the Ark Encounter, but the Creation Museum seems to me to fall into a lot of what I see in other forms of non-mainstream discourse when it does come to things like science. Michelle Hanks, who we've not had on the show, but I think we've talked about, she did ethnography amongst ghost hunters in the UK. And I believe April Bisaw, when we had her on, mentioned her work. And yes. I've been working with Michelle, and you've met Michelle, Ken. She talked about how there was constant discussion of the skeptics. Not skeptics that were there. And we may be able to sort of touch on this after the break in another way with an experience I had recently. But not the skeptics who were there, but almost like the skeptics over the shoulder. And I've written, I have an article in our 2016 book about sort of this, that my steampunk inquiry article that's about this oppositionalist. And I saw a lot of that personally at the Creation Museum. When you talk about being maybe seen as a journalist, can you comment on what I think you can see where I'm going, James?
Well, go ahead and ask the question.
Ask a question. This feels like a grad school symposium where I've made a statement rather than ask a question. I mean, basically, does Toomey talk about creationists being oppositional and yes. to the larger mainstream as a major part of it? Because I see that personally. And how does that play in with maybe how some of the questions Ken was asking about sort of, you know, your reception and how they sort of front to the exterior world? And if that's too big a question, we can do it after the break. Sarah, I'll leave that up to you.
Sarah, I can just briefly, and then we can take a break if you want.
Okay. No, if you can answer briefly, I mean, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, so short answer would be yeah. I mean, Toomey does talk about it. You know, central, if you want to use the metaphor of DNA, the cultural DNA of creationism is antagonistic to the core. You know, they don't, fundamentalism broadly doesn't exist without this contentious dialogue with both modern science and modern biblical criticism. Mm-hmm. And
a less literal perspective.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. People sort of trying, not reading the Bible literally throughout, basically. And now, yeah, I mean, how that plays into why they would have allowed me to be around. I would need to.
I mean, it may not. Just basically when Toomey came up, it kind of made me think about that. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go to break real quick, and when we come back, we're gonna shift gears, but not quite, because Jeb has some interesting stories he wants to tell us about his weekend vacation.
Hey, podcast fans, check out the ARC 365 podcast at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365. That's ARCH 365 for your daily dose of archaeology. Each episode is less than 15 minutes long, and we have some great guests recording about awesome archaeology. We also try to throw in some definitions and basic archaeological information. So, check out the 365 Days of Archaeology podcast only in 2017 at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365 today. Find us also on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Music by typing ARC365 into the search. Now back to the show.
Hey everyone, and we are back, and we are still talking with James Bielow about the ARC experience. But before we get back into that, Jeb, you had an interesting side story that actually feeds into what we've been talking about.
Well, it absolutely does. And we mentioned this on an earlier show that I was going to go to Frankfort, Kentucky to CryptidCon, a convention about cryptozoology. And I was actually going to go with two people who have both been on the show, and we've been on their shows, Sharon Hill of Doubtful News and 15 Credibility Street, and Blake Smith of Monster Talk, which you may remember we did a crossover show. And I'm sure my advisor is very happy to hear about fairies last year. She, little people, and so forth. I'm sure he's very proud.
It was a good episode.
But it was a good episode. And one of the things that quite surprised me, and probably before this comes out, you can hear me talk about this with Sharon and Blake, was when we went to CryptidCon, you listen to interviews, podcasts, you read some books from a lot of the people of the kind of sort that would be there. Although a lot of people there were kind of chill, but on these topics, there is a lot of what I was mentioning with Michelle Hanks is of sort of like engaging with the skeptic who's not there, engaging with the ever-present invisible skeptic, and how we've become almost kind of a great Satan. And we were expecting not fisticuffs, though I did train in advance. But there was very little of that. I mean, not even directed towards us. I mean, it was just directed towards the audience. Far less than if I listen to a podcast or I see an interview or I see blog posts or whatever. There was very little of that. And I don't know if it was because it was their event or maybe it was a particular people. And when I did hear it, it was actually more from the audience than from the speakers. So I think maybe that's why it's sort of on my mind, this idea of sort of confrontation. And you have a book coming out on this. Can you tell us a little bit more about that briefly, James?
So about how skeptics sort of figure in the creationist imagination?
Well, no, just about your work.
Oh, no, yeah, I am sure. Interested in what you just said.
Yeah, I can follow up on that, and I'll do my best to seamlessly segue into a shameless self-promotion.
Yeah, no, start with the shameless self-promotion. Just go for
that's
it.
That's what this podcast is all
about. Absolutely.
This is true, yeah. Okay,
now I know for sure. Okay. So for readers who might be interested, in the summer from NYU Press, this book will come out, ARC Encounter, The Making of a Creationist Theme Park. And one of the analyses that I present actually across a couple of chapters is how, just as you said, the cultural figure of the skeptic, the atheist, the evolutionist, as they would say, the secularist, as they would say, absolutely sort of dominates their discourse. And it dominates the discourse, you know, when you sort of buy a book from, you know, Ken Ham, who's one of the founders of Answers in Genesis and kind of the major public face. Some people might remember he debated Bill Nye back in February 14.
Yes, the Ham on Nye debate.
Yeah, exactly. So when you read Ken Ham, right, it's constantly there. When you walk through ARC Encounter and you interact with the signage, they say, you know, secularists always say, you know, things like this. But you know what? It was also there in the creative process of the team. You know, as they were putting together an exhibit, they would sort of role play in this imagined position of, if I were an atheist, how would I respond to this? That was part of how they made exhibits, which to me was really striking.
That's actually a really smart way to do it, though.
Yeah? Why do you say that?
Well, because if you're trying to argue a point and you're trying to convince someone of your argument, the best way to do that is to consider the arguments that are going to counter your position. So it's actually very smart of them when they're putting their, I mean, not that I agree with anything that they've done, but when they put their displays together to say, I know that there are people who are counter to this, what might they say, and how can I respond to that in a way that might change someone's opinion?
Mm. Yeah, but that presupposes, Sarah, and I'm not sure it's true, that presupposes that they care that there's an argument out there, or that they care that there are people who are going to disagree, because that's not their audience. It certainly isn't their core audience. That's just a general question. Is ARC Encounter intended to convince people, or is it merely to reaffirm what the folks going there already firmly believe?
Both and more.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, and this is, I mean, so just the punchline of the book, I'll sort of give it away. Sorry, NYU.
All the sales just disappeared.
Oh, right. I hope not.
Such as they were. So certainly, ARC Encounter and the Creation Museum exist to edify the already committed, creationists, mm-hmm. diehard creationists who buy the books and go to the conferences and buy season passes to the museum. It's for them. It's to bolster them and embolden them, to send them out back out into the world more prepared to witness as a creationist to non-creationists. And that includes other Christians, of course, and Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, right? Essentially anyone who's not in the creationist camp, right? It's for them. It's also meant to be an evangelistic tool, right? They know full well and expect that people who disagree with them and openly and sort of hedonistically enjoy disagreeing with them will come, and they'll come to mock. And of course, this fits very nicely within one of their biblical tropes, right? Mm-hmm. Just as Noah was mocked, they will be mocked. And so it's for them. It's meant to, as they would say, plant a seed. It's a $92 million seed planting ministry. but it's also to do so. The punchline of the book is that while those two things are true and they're happening, there's a sort of a more durable kind of cultural work that's happening. And that is to mobilize the power of immersive entertainment to make a claim for the cultural authority and legitimacy that science has. They want a piece of the pie. They want to be heard. They want to be listened to. They want to be trusted. Mm-hmm. And it's their commitment that by sort of pulling off this $92 million attraction and bringing people in and getting their message out there and being featured on the news and all of the things that go with it, that they are making a play for that cultural authority and legitimacy.
Is there in the exhibits there, and for both you and Jeb, the question is in the exhibits at the Creation Museum, is there an explicit attempt on the part of the producers of these museums to associate these biblical claims with real gosh darn scientists with PhDs?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
There is. Okay.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So the ministry employs several PhDs from places like Brown and Ohio State, who just also happen to be young earth creationists, most of whom for a long time, they didn't retire and then become a.
Can I throw in that it's Ohio State, not the Ohio State, which apparently are two completely different schools?
You can. You
actually and
can.
The Ohio State people will get very specific about that.
Yeah. I think that this speaks to maybe one of the reasons that it was of interest to me for me to come on the podcast. I know I'm not an archaeologist. I've enjoyed listening to several episodes, and I enjoy talking with Jeb around the office about the episodes. But it is uncommon, right, to have an ethnographer on.
And by the way, since we're in the all the praise moment, we met several fans of the show who were at CryptidCon and were very excited to meet us. So that was really actually quite awesome. I just wanted to put that out there. So anyway.
No, I was just going
to
say that.
Back to the praising.
I think that,
hallelujah.
I'm sorry.
The Holy Ghost. I didn't know the Holy Ghost was going to descend on this podcast.
Not sure it's a Holy Ghost. I'm pretty sure it's not, actually.
Jeb talks in tongues fairly frequently during the podcast. So
that's an unfair thing to say about my hieroglyphs episode.
Well, he did at the conference anyway with some of those fans.
Oh my.
So no, it's the relationship with the past that I find fascinating, that I think links my work with archaeological work that's interested in. To drop a nod to this volume that came out, that Jeb and David Anderson edited, Lost City, Found Pyramid.
Where you have a chapter in there.
Yeah, public understandings of science and public treatments and engagements with science. To me, this is a fascinating ethnographic question, how people try to mobilize different pieces of the past to say something in the present about who they are and what they care about and how they want the world to look.
Well, I think it's a fantastic step off point to not change what we're talking about, but one, Ken, you had wanted to ask what sort of people are involved in this.
Right,
And frankly, what I think it'd be really cool to hear is whether it's Ark Encounter or the Creation Museum, or alternatively, some non-AIG, because you also have, since we're in the shameless promotion part of the show, you also have, if I remember correctly, the specific name is a big website you've been building with various colleagues, Materializing the Bible. Could you talk a little about that and maybe talk about ways archaeology and material evidence of the past is used and deployed in various sorts of senses that you've been studying?
No, yeah, that's great. So Ken, I think you were interested in sort of the question of the labor. You know, were these artists just hired hands, or are they insiders themselves? So to work for AIG, you sign a statement of faith, and that statement of faith, I think it has like 22 or probably more than that points, individual points.
How do they get away with that legally?
Well, that's what got them in trouble. That's why they've been in the news a lot. And right now they seem to not be in trouble with the state, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a longer answer. Maybe we can circle back to that.
No, that's fine. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to derail
us. Does that imply for the guys who got hired to do the plumbing work in Ark Encounter, or just the people doing the artistic?
I think it implies to the people that like sell the popcorn.
Seriously? Yes.
Yeah.
Any sort of
person working at one of these parks, the park or the museum or any of the attractions. So yes, they are. They're all committed creationists, and for them, that's crucial for their identity. And they would say you can't do the work without it. And so they an interesting example that segues into some of Jeb's question: the Holy Land experience in Orlando, Florida, which is sort of a create. It started as a creation Zionist, Christian Zionist theme park.
And I want to be clear, this is not AIG.
Right. Yeah, this is not AIG. Right. It was started in 2001. It was bought by TBN, this major charismatic mass media broadcasting conglomerate, in 2007, I believe. And the Holy Land Experience hired a media company to do all of their exhibits. And this media company will work for anyone, you know, as long as the contract works for both parties. And the creation, the creative team often pointed to the Holy Land Experience as this kind of creative other. This is a place that, you know, their heart's in the right spot, but they got it wrong. Cool. And one reason that the team thinks they got it wrong is that because they didn't do it all in-house.
Which is a thing that we've talked about with media and science and archaeology, where we've been very unhappy with media representation. So anyway, just wanted to mention that.
Yeah. Yeah. So by no means is Ark Encounter one of a kind in a sense. It is, as they're very fond of saying, the world's largest timber frame structure, a freestanding timber frame structure. So in some ways, sure, it's distinctive, but it actually participates in a really long and global history of what I like to call materializing the Bible, which is transforming the written words of Scripture into a physical, experiential, choreographed environment. And so you see recreations of Noah's Ark, you see recreations of the Garden of Eden, the Tabernacle in the Wilderness, Solomon's Temple. You see, of course, classic, or I shouldn't say classic, but, you know, very historic ritual forms like the Stations of the Cross and the Scala Sancta, which is these 28 steps that Jesus was said to have gone up to meet Pilate. And the Empress Helena brought them to Rome in the 4th century. And so you see all over the world replicas of the Scala Sancta. So in all kinds of ways, Christian communities find ways to materialize the Bible. And so the, you know, Sarah, in answer to your initial question of, am I at the beginning or the end of this project? I'm at the end of my work specifically on Ark Encounter in the museum, but I'm really at the beginning of a broader project trying to contextualize the Ark in the museum as part of this broader genre of placemaking. Really interested in why places are powerful and how they work via materiality, how they, you know, impact the body and mobilize the senses, how they use different objects. And I'll get to your question in a second, Jeb, about archaeological objects, technology of various forms.
No, that's really fascinating that they're creating basically a world space for themselves based on scripture and readings and interpretations of history and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it. You know, absolutely. They're creating a biblical environment, you know, a place where you can come and play in the scriptural past. You can come and sort of step into place, right?
You've just made them role players.
Yeah, they're absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Jeb, one of our emails, we were talking about
role playing is crucial to something like religion.
And you've cited, in fact, in the excerpt you sent of some of your work today, you cited Joseph Laycock, who we've talked about on the show before, and he's working with us in various ways, and he has very explicitly made that relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, core to this phenomenon of materializing the Bible is this practice and process of creating a relationship to the past. And so whenever you're creating a relationship to the past, at least in the context of modernity, you're interacting with historical sciences like archaeology. And so constantly these sites are engaging with archaeological material. One of my favorite examples, and this is also a site that's in northern Kentucky, there are many other sites like it, recreations of the Garden Tomb in Jerusalem, which I don't know if you guys know the story of the Garden Tomb.
Why don't you tell it even if we do? Because our audience may well not.
Yeah, good point. So the short version would be something like this. Since the 4th century, Catholic and Eastern Orthodox communities identified this biblical site, Calvary Hill, sometimes called Golgotha, where Jesus was crucified, and the site where he was buried and resurrected, as being housed under this modern structure called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. There's pilgrimages there, thousands of people every day of the year, in and out of the Holy Sepulchre. And of course, so when Protestants started developing a more elaborate relationship with the Holy Land, which was sort of in the early 1800s, kind of 1820s, they started doing archaeological studies and geological and geographic studies of the Holy Land. And then modern tourism and pilgrimage later on in the 19th century. Protestants have their relationship with the Holy Land is defined by this kind of difficulty with Catholicism, right? Catholicism has a deeper claim to the Holy Land than they do. And so it's the job of Protestants to sort of construct new relationships. And so in the 1870s, I believe it was, this site, which is now called the Garden Tomb, which is outside of the old city walls in Jerusalem, right? The Church of the Holy Sepulchre is inside the old city walls. Mm-hmm. This site called the Garden Tomb was, quote unquote, discovered. And it was discovered by a British General Gordon. I forget his last name
at the moment. The one who gets killed at Khartoum, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so he, through a dream, was shown, it was revealed to him, presumably by the Holy Spirit, where the actual tomb of Jesus was. And so immediately this became controversial. And so he starts doing all sorts of archaeological excavation around the tomb. And immediately Protestants love it. And they love it for a lot of reasons. They love it because it's outdoors. It's not inside this church full of as some Protestants say, smells and bells, right? There's not incense everywhere and ritual shrines, and you're not surrounded by pilgrims performing, you know, ritual actions on the site. It's outside. It's not bothered by any of that ritual stuff. And so it becomes this Protestant alternative to the site where Jesus was crucified, buried, and resurrected, which, as you can imagine, matters a whole lot to a whole lot of people. And so it's been, you know, throughout the 20th century, people were sort of presenting archaeological evidence for and against the Garden Tomb. And my understanding is that, and I've not read deeply in the archaeological literature, but my understanding is that any mainstream archaeologist, Christian or not, Protestant or not, Catholic or not, rejects the Garden Tomb on archaeological grounds, right? They don't see the evidence. It's not there. But it just doesn't matter to people, right? It doesn't matter. They continue to see it. And so you see replicas of the Garden Tomb throughout the world. And there's a replica of the Garden Tomb that's been there since 1958 in northern Kentucky.
Huh.
I did not know that. Is it? I assume it's very pretty, though.
The site?
The replica.
Garden, so I think like flowers and trees and sculpture and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the guy who made it brought over hundreds of native species. They're native to Palestine.
Really?
Create this Holy Land environment. Again, experience the Holy Land through your senses and then see this recreation. Step inside the tomb. Of course, people will get their picture taken next to the tomb replica, just like they get their picture taken next to the actual Garden Tomb in Jerusalem.
Well, unless you have a picture, it didn't really happen. So,
well, and that whole replica thing, we're about to head to break, but that whole replica thing, it's a fascinating question. And as we've discussed, I work with 3D tech, 3D scanning and printing. So it's very forefront on my mind amongst other topics I work on. And when I talk to my students, for example, I just had my students turn in today an assignment on Chauvet Cave. They watched the movie Cave of Forgotten Dreams with Werner Herzog. You cannot go to Chauvet Cave, but you can now go to a replica, just as you can go to a replica of Lascaux, which is literally called Lascaux 2.
Lascaux 2.
And you can now go to a replica of King Tutankhamun's King Tut's tomb, which they've put right near Howard Carter's like field house. And I always ask my students, and I don't have an answer to this. Is this a thing you'd want to do? And I think this gets into, and I think when we come back from break, I think this is something we've definitely, because this is what James has been working on, can talk about this intersection of science, play, sacrality, and sort of materialization. Does a thing have to be, and I don't want to get all Baudrillard here, quote unquote real? For it to have a value.
No, I think you have an excellent point. It's the concept of the shrine, in that it doesn't have to be. It can be a shrine to a place, and therefore it doesn't have to necessarily be the place itself. But it still maintains that holiness or that effectiveness because it's merely a replica, painstakingly recreated.
I was just gonna say, Jim makes a good point about the playfulness. There are more than a dozen Stonehenge replicas in the United States, and they all kind of play on you know, they're jokey, but nevertheless, a bunch of folks were posting online photographs of the eclipse at Carhenge.
Right, exactly.
It was actually pretty damn moving, even though, my God, are cars.
I mean, Cheesehenge, and I mean, look at Las Vegas. I mean, how many well-known...
The Luxor Hotel.
Exactly.
Right? The Sphinx.
Yeah, with the pyramid there and that kind of stuff.
I think we're about to go to break, but I thought maybe I'd throw out a question.
Sure.
That you guys could, maybe we could deal with it when we get back.
Yeah.
Ken, I love your point about sort of the fact that a replica can absolutely sort of affectively stir an audience. Absolutely.
Sure.
So you know, here, the first Holy Land recreation in the United States took place at a Sunday school training retreat center in lower New York State, the Chautauqua Institution. Mm-hmm. And part of it was about training Sunday school teachers, but it also was about, and every Holy Land replica since, including the site in Kentucky, the Garden of Hope, offers visitors a kind of surrogate pilgrimage experience. If you can't go to the Holy Land, come here. And so I'm wondering if a scientific replica, if you can sort of do surrogate science or surrogate discovery through a replica.
Let's pick that up. Let's pick that up after the break. And then I think we also are going to talk about some of these concepts of play as you've seen them in design.
Sounds great.
Interested in archaeology? Want to hear from experts in the field about the latest discoveries and interpretations? Check out The Archaeology Show every other Saturday and let hosts Chris Webster and April Camp Whitaker take you deeper into the story. Check out The Archaeology Show at www.archpodnet.com/archaeology and subscribe, rate, and comment on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and the Google Music Store. That's www.archpodnet.com/archaeology. Now back to the show.
And we are back, and we are still talking with James Belio about the Ark experience and his ethnographic work with the creators of that. And you had asked us this really interesting question right before we had gone. Right, repeating it real quick? Or...
Not at all.
Great.
And yeah, part of the fun of this conversation, it's actually not a question that I've asked myself before, so I'm very curious. So I was thinking about, you know, is there an analog between going to a Holy Land replica as surrogate pilgrimage and going to a replica of the caves in southern France as a kind of surrogate science or surrogate discovery or surrogate expedition or something. So just curious to hear your thoughts.
I can't talk too much about like an actual place because I'm not sure anything like that has been recreated. But I know that this kind of gets into the realm of 3D printed objects, and those have been being scanned and introduced into classrooms as study guides or study aids.
Oh, I bring in 3D prints.
Jeb does that all the time.
I do it in addition. I bring in real artifacts. So the last 2 weeks, I've been teaching human evolution. James has seen this. I brought it into a faculty meeting. Every day, I am carrying a box full of replica skulls.
It's true.
Replica fossils, replica skulls. I bring in replica tools. I also bring in real things. There have been a few sites. We mentioned the Tutankhamun tomb, the Lascaux, the Chauvet. There are some others that have, in fact, been replicated. Far more interesting to possibly talk about in some sense, though those are interesting, is, of course, as has been argued by many archaeologists, archaeological sites are in themselves usually replicas. If you go to Tikal has been rebuilt. A particular time period at the Maya city of Tikal has been reconstructed. I know some of the people that did it. And that is true of almost, you know, Stonehenge did not look the way it does a century ago. There were more stones down. When I went to Avebury, a whole bunch of those had fallen over. Some have simply been replaced with concrete markers.
Well, now that you mention it, museums oftentimes will recreate sections of sites. I know the Smithsonian here in D.C. have several of the prehistoric sites, especially in their human evolution section, which are recreating the cave paintings there. That's probably the closest I'm ever going to get to those paintings, but they took the time to recreate them in detail, and it's actually kind of moving to stand next to them and look at them. And I'm sure if you were someone who spent your entire life studying those, you could probably walk in and be like, psh, whatevs. But for someone like me, who I'm like, well, this is as close as I'm gonna get, it's really cool.
The place I went and did my graduate work, the Mid-American Research Institute at Tulane University, has now been moved downstairs in Dinwiddie Hall, but it used to be on the fourth floor, and it was pretty much the simulation of a pyramid because it was hot and humid, and you had to climb four stories of stairs up to this thing, and at the top were two plaster versions of basically feathered serpent heads flanking a narrow doorway. When you came up this doorway, I shit you not, there was a giant stone head, a real one from Honduras, staring at you in a dark tomb-like corridor. And if you looked to your right, all the way down, approximately 100 feet down, was a replica of one of the major friezes at Palenque. And there were a number of things like that with real objects mixed in it. And museums do this all over the world. If you want to go see the Egyptian things at the Field Museum, you enter through a replica mastaba.
Well, and bringing it even more to the future, more to the present, historical house museums are almost always, like, the house itself may be the original house, but it's most certainly been reconstructed at some point. And usually most of the items inside of the house are
brought in from somewhere else, and they're simply as close as they can get, or they're replicas within photos that they have had made. I mean,
and they would often be showing the house at its most sort of intricate or ornate.
Exactly.
Again, just like they didn't replicate 3rd century Tikal, they replicated 8th century Tikal when there was the most buildings lined.
Exactly. So yeah, I think there's a lot of merit to that.
Yeah. Also, what's cool in here in Massachusetts, Old Sturbridge Village, all of the houses are all original, but they've been moved to create a simulated 19th century village. Yeah. And yeah. So that Old Sturbridge Village was never a village, and those houses come from all over New England, but they're brought together to in as a piece to simulate the village itself. And yeah. Of course, all the stuff inside. And in some cases, the material, for example, in one of the stores at Old Sturbridge Village, the material in the store is stuff that was excavated by historical archaeologists, and whole pieces end up as being displayed in the store as if they were for sale.
Well, and to take that even one step further, I mean, look at in New Zealand, you can go to the Prancing Pony and you can stay at the Prancing Pony Inn.
Right, right.
But that's the same kind of thing. It's a reconstruction out of the movie. So it kind of brings us back to this whole, the biblical thing where we're reconstructing things based out of a text, you know, something that we haven't actually seen with our eyes, but we're recreating it based on what we consider a historical.
Yeah,
as well as the material, yes, world, right? You know, the historical artifacts that the, you know, makers of the Lord of the Rings series used to imagine, you know, what the elves were.
Exactly. Right. And so it's an interpretation of what they think that would be like. And I think that's very, I think that parallels nicely with what you were mentioning.
Well, I think it's funny you bring up Lord of the Rings and the elves and all of that, because I, you know, if you go back to a lot of the design notes, I mean, some of it is original, but not surprisingly, given that Tolkien was a medievalist and so on, you look at the Rohirrim and they're wearing Anglo-Saxon shit, which I know in your article in our book Lost City Found Pyramid, James, that you talk about a lot of influences that were used and a lot of sort of historical research that was done by the AIG design team, not when they were working on the Ark Encounter, but when they were working on is it Dragon Invasion, if I remember right?
Dragon Legends.
Dragon Legends exhibit at the Creation Museum. Can you talk a little bit more about that? And like, the one that sticks in my head is the Beowulf helmet.
Yeah. So the nutshell of the exhibit is that it's a materialized embodiment of their argument that dragon legends are proof that humans and dinosaurs coexisted, right? Right. Which of course is
and we've talked about this exhibit on the show before.
Yeah, yeah, and okay. We've talked about the dragon.
Yeah. So the team. The team, first off, was quite small. It was the creative director, and it was three main artists. Now, as the art project developed, they hired a bunch of other artists who worked under those four main artists. But the four main artists are the ones I got to know the best. And each one had a bookshelf next to their cubicle. And their bookshelf had a few, probably more than a few. It had a good number of AIG materials, you know, Answers Magazine, their monthly periodical. Books published by Masters Books, which is this publishing house that pretty much exclusively publishes Answers in Genesis. So they had that stuff, but in equal number, they had movie books and they had concept art books from Lord of the Rings, from Star Wars, Star Trek, King Kong, The Last Airbender.
So what were they doing with them?
So they used them for inspiration. The artistic style of Dragon Legends,
right,
came directly from this animated movie, The Book of Kells. The Secret of the Kells.
Which is based on the historical The Book of Kells.
Yeah, this Irish illuminated Bible, famous.
Absolutely beautiful stuff.
Yeah, beautiful illuminated manuscripts. So that was the style that they wanted to follow. That was the aesthetic that they wanted the whole exhibit to sort of be in the mold of. And the reason was, is that it was not too realistic, because they wanted, the whole exhibit plays with, is it real? Is it not? Are these actual dragon legends of a dinosaur or of a snake? But ultimately, the abundance of dragon legends around the world for them is evidence that humans and dinosaurs live together. So that was how they used these books, was really as artistic inspiration. Not to take a step back, you're entertaining this question. I think it was really fascinating. One takeaway is that replication has power. It has power affectively to move you, to stir you, to stop you in your tracks. It has power pedagogically to teach, to instruct. But that power sort of hinges on your willingness to give yourself over to the play experience, that it's real enough or close enough to real. And roughly the same, or something to this effect. And to me, that's a sort of a fun and really valuable observation about something that religion and science both do.
A little more than a year ago, I was at Foamhenge, which is a life-size replica of Stonehenge in Virginia, made of styrofoam. And we ran into other people there. It's Mark Klein is the artist who produced it, and it's very playful. And there's a scene there of Merlin the magician surfing one of the Sarsen stones down the hill. But the science says, well, this is one hypothesis, and he's obviously making fun. But we ran into a bunch of native Virginians there who all seemed very impressed by it and said, this is really interesting. And boy, this is a lot cheaper than going to the real place. So it was, this was their Stonehenge experience. This was the Stonehenge experience they could afford, and they appreciated it for what it was worth. They seemed moved by it.
Well, here's a question, Ken. Can you touch the stones there?
You certainly can.
Well, that beats the other one.
Yeah, you can touch. You can walk right within all the stones. You can walk, and it actually looked pretty good. Ultimately, it was on a state or town park, and the town said, no, we don't like the fact that there's a replica Stonehenge here, and they made him move it. And I think it's been re-erected somewhere else.
It's a natural bridge.
Yeah, if it's the same guy, he's had a lot of issues with, because he has famously the Jurassic Park meets the Civil War.
Dinosaur Kingdom 2.
Yes, which is amazing. But like, he at one point, apparently somebody came and destroyed a bunch of his stuff.
Aw, he's
had some issues apparently with local something. Who knows what's going on.
Right.
But see, there's the value in that kind of stuff, though. The ability to walk up and touch those things and like experience them is not something, like Jeb said, you can't do that at Stonehenge. They won't let you.
There was a fiberglass stone at Stonehenge that was made up to be on the so there's Stonehenge itself, and then once you left there, go back to like the thing, the sort of visitor center, and then the gift shop. The gift shop, which is the exact same size as the entire museum at the visitor center. There's outside a sort of faux Neolithic village, all very fiberglassy in various places, and there is a faux Sarsen that is on rollers, and you're sort of allowed to try to pull this thing, and people were touching it. And there was also a sample of gray stone and a sample of blue stone, and people were touching that. And frankly, they were clearly happier in many respects by being able to have material contact, even with something that was made of fiberglass.
Well, yeah, because we are inherently curious creatures, and we want to handle and touch and feel. I mean, we have six or five senses for a reason. And so having tactile things that we can manipulate and look at and hold up to your eyeballs and look at every nick and cranny, we like that kind of stuff, and that makes anything more engaging. That's why 3D printed objects, I'm all for them being used as teaching aids, because Jeb, you were talking about bringing in your 3D printed skulls. If those were even the more fancier replicas, would you really let your students manhandle those things if you paid $1,500 for one of them?
Depends how much I like the student.
Well, exactly, but that's my point. But your nice plastic resin ones, you have probably no problem being like, here, catch, you know? That's my point.
Well, I make all sorts of poor choices. But
can I ask a question there?
Sure.
Yes.
So is there any, and I don't know the answer, the one or the three or all three of you might know, is there an argument within the archaeological community against using 3D objects.
Yes, and it gets into discussions of cultural appropriation and who owns images, who owns the past. It has been most around human remains. So for example, there was a discussion earlier this year. A company that shall go unnamed, it was selling replicas of the skull that has been referred to as the Ancient One, also referred to as Kennewick Man, who was repatriated earlier this year after genetic evidence made it very clear that he was a direct ancestor to the locals who continue to live there today. And there was a lot of outcry that this object that had been repatriated, and by object I mean a person's remains, a replica of this person's remains, was being sold. And the question was, can you repatriate if you've made a fairly detailed physical copy and it is outside control? And that raises a whole bunch of questions. And to my mind, in the Kennewick case, the answer should be, you know what? This is a done friggin' deal, and all the reasons that it was intriguing certain people are no longer scientifically legitimate reasons. So you know what? Let it lie. But on the other hand, there was discussion of, at the same time, and I think we'll find the blog post that brought this up, of a Clovis point, an actual Clovis point, being brought to the International Space Station. And whether this was a worthwhile sort of thing. And that got in some interesting sort of contrasts. But no, there actually is very much a discussion of this. On the other hand, I would also say that some of this discussion gets into nationalism and to tourism money. There have been, for example, several replica sphinxes which have been taken down in China at the request of the Egyptian government. And on the one hand, I can understand that. On the other hand, is it really? I have opinions. I have various opinions.
It's a very robust argument. Yeah, there's a very robust argument that's going on, and there's merit on both sides. I lean more towards the side of it's for teaching purposes. We should be doing that. But at the same time, especially with the 3D objects, you know, those files go out. They're out there for anyone to use. You really want human remains out there like that, that kind of a thing. So like I said, there's a robust conversation happening, and there's merit on both sides. But, you know.
Ken, what's your take on this?
You know, I'm not sure. Like, we use 3D replicas all of the time, but I can understand it certainly. In the case of human remains, it's if you personalize it. If supposing somebody had replicated your grandfather's skull and was using it as a part of a teaching collection, would that be weird for you? Would it be?
I think you're asking the wrong crowd here. I mean, that's right. Well, that's
no.
kind of getting.
Oh, right, no.
But the,
yeah, exactly.
The other end of that question is okay, you've got this scan of your grandfather's skull, and it's out there for teaching purposes. Hell, maybe he left his body to science, and it's legitimately out there to be studied. But then, like, somebody at home on Thingiverse finds that file, downloads it, prints it out, and turns it into a candy dish.
Or uses the file for a prop in a video game.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that can happen, and we don't have enough securities on those files right now.
And of course, the difference there is that you know, if your grandfather donated his body to science, Kennewick Man did not donate his body to science.
And
but
the same argument can be had with like artifacts. I mean, a lot of the objects that were repatriated were pipes and bowls and objects that we view as being kind of mundane, but are being viewed by the peoples that created them and requested those items back as being living objects that are not to be put into the public eye. So we give those objects back, but yet we keep a 3D file of it so we can print one at any point. You know, what does that mean if I just recreated a new one? Is it the same? Should I give them the 3D printed object? I mean, is it, you know, and these are the conversations that are happening around the objects.
Well, it seems to introduce a really, I think, fascinating wrinkle into what we called earlier the power of replication. It was sort of the limits of replication. And then this is something that communities of practice have to confront and figure out. It's bound to produce sort of divergence. I can imagine sort of similar things happening, actually, in context of biblical replication. I don't know why this example came to mind. There are probably other ones, but so, you know, in certain strains of fundamentalism, right, there's this theology of messianic return, you know, that Christ is coming again, and that, and this is sort of the Christian Zionist argument, that the reinstatement of the state of Israel is crucial to that, and that the rebuilding of the temple,
right,
where the Dome of the Rock stands, which is I think the second or third most holy place in Islam. So the recreation of the temple necessarily includes the destruction of the Dome of the Rock. But if you saw a replica be enough, even if it was in Israel, right, it has to be on that spot in that way. So there are limits of replication, and it's in the sort of the cultural practice of communities doing these performances that those limits get confronted and worked out.
Well, the thing I was going to immediately mention when you started talking about the replication of the temple in order to bring about the sort of, you know, return and end times and so forth, I immediately went to those people who were trying to biologically replicate, or they were, I don't know if they're still doing it, biologically replicate red heifers in order to consecrate the place.
Yeah.
Which I have thoughts about. So
that's weird.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll just leave that. We'll just leave that there, because this is a polite podcast. But we are about to head out, and I touched on this earlier, but I'd like you to frankly talk about it more, because I think it's a very interesting site, and you can be followed on Twitter with this. Can you talk a little bit more about what you're doing with this, and maybe future work, and particularly what you're doing with the website, the Materializing the Bible website?
Yeah, for sure. I'll try to keep it brief. I know we're coming up against our time.
We're a little fluid. Do what you want.
Yeah, so Materializing the Bible is a digital scholarship project that I launched in collaboration with undergraduate research assistants in July of 2015, and it sort of continues as a collaborative project with new undergraduate research assistants as they want to get involved, and they've been incredibly helpful. The project has expanded quite a bit. You know, its initial function was really just as a catalog, right? You know, sort of a one-stop shop. No other place could you find all of these places listed together.
And you just have a list. You have a map. You have an interactive map.
Yeah. So I wanted to provide that, and so we thought, okay, well, it'd be fun to provide it as not just a sort of a simple listing, but as in some interactive ways. So we just use a simple Google Map technology to place them, and you know, they're sorted into a few categories, and so one can explore them that way. And then the site has grown in two significant ways, I think. One is we've started doing virtual tours. So I mentioned the Garden of Hope in Northern Kentucky. You can go on and sort of have a bit of a replicated experience and go to the Garden of Hope.
Is that using your pictures or like Google Street View?
Yeah, no, these are all fieldwork images that either I've taken or their person. So in three cases, I collaborated with a colleague elsewhere. So shout out to Lena Rose at University of Oxford and Matt Tomlinson and some of his students at Australian National University, and Rosamond Rodman at Cal State Northridge, for taking wonderful photographs and writing some great narrative of sites that I am not able to get to. And then also some video and then some archival material. So that's the other way in which the project has extended. And for me, this has been one of the most exciting, because it's sort of stretched me methodologically, right? I'm used to working ethnographically. And so I've been dealing with a lot of archival material and really kind of building my own archive of materials related to these attractions. So I in fact, just got in the mail today a 1929 guidebook to a Catholic shrine in Quebec, which is fascinating. It really sort of embodies how modern tourism was fully in effect. They go right from discussing the Scala Sancta and its significance and its ties to Rome to when you step out, you see the beautiful scenery of Quebec, the Quebec countryside. So it's amazing. So collecting that archival material and trying to introduce some scans so that people can interact with that material if they want to teach.
Right. And we've talked a little bit about that. Yeah.
So I'm really loving it. It's should be another book. Actually, I'll be signing a book contract tomorrow with Bloomsbury Press to do a book that sort of extends from the digital project. But It'll really sort of work in collaboration with it. So that'll be fun to put together, a very different writing experience.
James, are you familiar with Holy Land USA in Waterbury, Connecticut?
Absolutely. I was there about a year and a half ago.
Oh, my God. So do they still let people up there? My understanding was that whoever owned the property had closed it down because it was unsafe.
It was purchased by local business owners. And so it plans to reopen, and they're kind of slowly trying to clean the place up. One of the most fascinating discoveries when I was there was not just sort of the wreckage of the place, which it absolutely is. And we were there on this kind of gray December day, so it really kind of looks apocalyptic. I can send you all a picture if you want.
Ooh, yeah, I love pictures.
But there's also a Boy Scout project, an Eagle Scout project from 2015, which is a small Tower of Babel replica painted brightly red that stands out amid this sort of rabid landscape.
It's all right, Jeff. It's all right.
I don't know what to say about that.
Eagle Scouts, that's all you need to know.
All right. Yeah, so in the near future, it may reopen.
Well, cool.
It's got a way to go, though, I have to say.
James, thank you so much for coming on the show. I usually ask for final thoughts at this point, but we've run over quite a bit. So thank you so much for coming on.
It's been great, James.
It really has. This is fascinating.
Thank you for having me. It was a really fun conversation, and I really enjoyed it.
Tell people the name of your forthcoming book one more
time. Yes, please.
It's Ark Encounter, The Making of a Creationist Theme Park.
Excellent.
Yes.
Do you have a date? Do you have a due date on that?
Oh, roughly June 2018 from okay. NYU Press.
All right.
So by that time, we'll convince Amazon to shrink wrap that book, Jeb's Spooky Archaeology, and My Frauds, Myths, and Mysteries, and they can sell them together as ironic Christmas presents.
You know, Ken, you think you're joking, but I can make that happen.
Oh my.
You think you're kidding, but I can make that happen. We can do it as a raffle, no less.
Oh, I'm intrigued.
All right. Well, this has been great fun.
Yeah. Yes,
thank you, James, and I'm sure I'll be hearing more about this work in the future.
Thank you all.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Trials as one will call. No, we don't do dinosaurs.
Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it. Our music was provided by Archaeosuit Productions. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe and rate us on iTunes or Stitcher and share us wherever you use social media. You can contact us with your questions, comments, or angry email at archaefantasies@gmail.com. You can follow the podcast at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaefantasies. You can follow the blog at www.archaefantasies.com and get updates on Tumblr and Twitter at @archaefantasies. You can also look for us on Facebook. If you're looking for the show notes for this episode, go to the podcast website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaefantasies. Thanks again for listening.
No, we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs. Don't do dinosaurs!
This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.